Hello, and welcome to Season 2, Episode 19 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee with Dr. Justin Winzenberg and me, Stephen Jones. After Justin and I discuss our highlights, lowlights, and insights for the week, we are joined for the second half of our conversation with Rachel Pye Jones, author of Pillars, How Muslim Friends Led Me Closer to Jesus.
You must have several lowlights after.
That's the thing. I've got plenty of those. Yeah.
So the highlight's going to be the tougher one, huh?
Oh, I do know.
Oh, okay. What's a highlight for you this week?
All right. So a highlight for me is on Tuesday, some of my students threw a little party on Tuesday night for my class. So my last classes were Tuesday and Thursday night. And yeah, so they got this balloon banner, you know, like a banner made out of balloons that said last hurrah. And they had asked earlier in the semester what some of my favorite foods were. And I hadn't quite forgotten, like it was still in the back of my mind that they had asked that. But, you know, anyway, yeah. So they had gotten some of my favorite foods that I'd mentioned. And yeah, it was very thoughtful. And that was nice because yeah, it's a season of a lot of lasts and many of them go unrecognized. And so I think for the students to recognize it and then also to celebrate that with me. This week was the last week of my on campus in-person classes. Even though it was as an adjunct, you know, it's still a last. And so it was just, yeah, it was nice to be able to celebrate with them. So how about for you? What's the highlight been?
Yeah. Well, no, I was going to say something quickly off of that, which was, it was a little bit weird because we've had these kind of going away parties and retirement parties for people among the faculty and staff who won't be with us next year.
Right.
And I just kept thinking like, why aren't you on this list?
Somebody asked me about that the other day. Yeah,
technically you must have ended your official, you know, obviously your official full-time term last year, which we didn't have a chance to even celebrate because it was like we had a virtual faculty meeting and that was it.
Right. That was it. Yep.
Yeah, that's a bummer. Weird. That's too bad that we weren't able to celebrate. I kind of wonder why that was never brought up. Was that intentional or?
I don't know.
Dang it. No, I'm sad now. I regret that I hadn't thought of it sooner and brought it up to somebody and be like, why isn't Jones being included in this?
That's funny.
I'm sorry. Yeah. I apologize on your behalf or having not stood up for you, but it literally didn't dawn on me until like one of these last few days where I was like, wait a second.
That's all right. Rob mentioned it too. He had the same question. And so he said maybe he'd try to throw a little something together. So we'll see.
So was that pretty weird feeling for you? I mean, so you were, how long were you on faculty full-time?
Full-time was 7 years and then 1 year as adjunct after that.
Wow. So it's been 8 years since you arrived in Minnesota.
Uh-huh.
And have been working at the same institution and now you taught your last class.
Yeah. It's a very strange feeling.
Not last class because, you know, we have every intention of continuing
sure.
teaching our classes together, but last class, you know, in terms of
on campus,
official capacity on campus.
Yeah.
So how does that feel?
As I was driving in, I had this awareness that it was the last time that I was making that journey, you know?
Oh.
Yeah. And it was a beautiful day. And it was just, it was like Minnesota being its best springtime self, you know, and it was just like, oh, this is hard to leave.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Which is interesting because in the adjunct role, I mean, not only is it less rewarding financially, it just, I don't feel like I've had the same connection with students that I normally have. So it's felt less rewarding overall, but it's still, I don't know, there's something good about it. Yeah. So it definitely feels sad to be experiencing that last. But
yeah.
Hey, you turned my highlight into a low light.
I'm sorry. Well, you can edit. You're a whiz at this editing stuff. So come on, you can turn that into the low light.
That's funny.
I did. I'm sorry. I hijacked that.
What's a highlight been for you?
Well, a highlight for me is the end of the school year. You know, we maybe mentioned that my highlight and my low light. I feel like this is something we've mentioned before, but I don't know for sure. So I apologize to our listeners if they feel like it's deja vu, but a highlight is that's the end of the year. And that like, as in academia, we just work on a totally different timeline and calendar from the rest of the world. In that once, you know, the middle of May hits and everybody goes home for the summer, Like, you don't see people for 3 months, or in some cases, if they're departing, meaning they've graduated or they're, you know, leaving their post on faculty or staff, then we might not see them for a long time. Mm-hmm. And that's sobering. But this is supposed to be a highlight, man. What am I doing here? This is not working out. You know what? This night business, you know, we usually record, our listeners might not know this, but we usually record this at like in the morning or at worst early afternoon. And tonight, right, the late night for us. So this is odd. So maybe it's just throwing me off. But no, a highlight is that it is the end of the year, which for a long time I've never really been able to enjoy, because then it usually means I'm in full board PhD mode, which
I'm trying to remember timing. Is this your first summer out of PhD or second?
Technically my second. Yeah. But okay. Last summer was interesting because we had just had our youngest and he was about 3 months old. And so that meant I was going to be spending a lot of time at home with him.
Right.
During the summer. And so,
of course, with it being a COVID summer, just nothing was normal. But
exactly. Yeah. So this summer, the COVID restrictions are being heavily lifted so that there's not many remaining. And my sons are going to be in daycare some, so I might actually have some free days here. That'll be something new.
Might actually get to do some reading that you want to do.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So there you go. That's a highlight of mine. End of the year, academic year means a new summer for me.
Nice.
Something I've never quite experienced before.
What's a low light been for you?
So along with, this is where I've already gone into it a bit, because I've been throwing a bummer into the mix of all the highlights, is being at it to the end of the year. It's so weird that you're with students for 4 years.
Yeah.
Then they're gone. They graduate, and then you may not see many of them much. And then you've got your faculty and staff you've been with for a long time, some of who are retiring and whatnot, and they're gone too. So big low light with the end of the school year is just that overwhelming feeling of like every year things are different. Things change, even if the culture doesn't always change, even when it should change, even if the culture doesn't always change, the people that come through are very different from year to year. And that makes things very different in a work environment. And it's not that I only want to talk about work, but it is interesting to think about how much time you spend at work.
Yeah, so absolutely. It's like,
man, really, when the students change and some of the faculty and staff change, that can drastically change one's work experience when you're in academics. So that's a low light for sure. Some real good students who will be missing, and you're leaving, and that is probably the biggest low light. I'm not even joking in saying that.
Well, thanks.
It's weird. Yeah. We haven't had a chance to see each other face to face.
Hardly at all this year. Yeah.
And think about how in the previous years, like, man, if we went, because my office was down the same hall as yours, if we went 2 days without seeing each other, that'd be weird.
Yeah.
So I'm really going to miss you. I mean, I know we're going to be chatting still, and we're going to be probably seeing each other virtually and then hopefully in person in some creative ways, but I'm going to miss having you around campus. I already have missed having you, having not crossed paths as much, but that's probably my biggest low light.
Yeah.
How about for you?
I think so I'm in a season of a lot of endings, and some of them I'm able to notice, and some of them I'm not. And I actually, I'm doing a podcast with a couple of people dealing specifically with the transition itself. We were talking about some of those things, but I think the other thing that's going on is there are just so many moving pieces right now as we get ready to move, and like the uprooting is painful, and there's so many more roots than I knew. So like, for example, one of the things that we're having to do is get the house ready to sell. And so I mentioned a couple of weeks ago that we're, you know, going through all the stuff, but there's also just the space. And like, even right now, the house doesn't feel like my house. It's been staged for photos, you know, for selling. And it just doesn't feel like my space. Even like having less stuff in it, the acoustics are different. It just, I don't feel at home in my home, and I didn't expect that to happen yet. And at the same time, I have to function at a fairly high level right now. And we were talking about this before we started, but, you know, a kind of highlight, I guess, is that I got scheduled for my dissertation defense. But the timing is like just right in the middle of all of this.
Which, by the way, normally, you know, in case you hadn't picked up, a PhD defense is a great causer of stress for people.
Yes.
When there is nothing else going on in a person's life. So, oh, I can't imagine. Well,
maybe the good news is I won't feel the stress because I don't have space to.
Or you just won't be able to partition it out to figure out where it's coming from. It's got this
right.
angle from that angle from. In some ways, you'd be like a deer in headlights where you don't really have time to even stop and think of where it's all coming from. You kind of just have absolutely. To keep going.
So all of that though, it does make me think of an insight. Because I think, so I just today finished the back room that I've been working on in the garage, right? Which I've been using it. It's been usable for about 6 months now, or 5 months, I guess. But so I've gotten some good joy out of that space. But something that I've been thinking about is this is not the first time that we have finished a remodel project right as we move. and I think in some ways it's, you know, it's certainly sad, but I think there's something about remembering to live for the kingdom, right? Like if the kingdom that I'm living for is not my own kingdom, then doing something because it's good, adding value to the world is good. Adding beauty, hopefully, to the world is good because it's an expression of the kingdom and an expression of the character of the Father. And so there's goodness in it, whether or not I actually get to stick around and enjoy it. So it's kind of a melancholy insight. Like on the one hand, there's this, sense of, excitement in the completion of that space. And I really am excited about how it turned out. I'm also like, wow, I really would have loved if this had been this space the whole 7 years we've lived in this house.
Yeah.
And we knew when we moved in that we wanted to do that in that space. And it just, there were some challenges we had to overcome. We had to get asbestos professionally removed and, you know, things like that just slowed us way down. But yeah. So anyway, that's such as it is. That's the insight is that it's worth doing good things because good things are good and not necessarily because I get to enjoy them.
Yeah. That's a good insight, but it's hard though, isn't it? Because I get what you're going with it and that, you know, you put all that energy and that time into it in a space that you've really owned and you've really been in and embraced over the last 8 years. And then to see it finally come to completion, but not be able to kind of see it out and to see the dream that you've created, you know, kind of lived out within your family. That's got to be tougher too.
Yeah. And we got a taste of it, which I think that's better than not getting a taste of it. But
yeah.
How about for you? What's an insight, Ben?
Well, you know, I'm wondering too about my comments about end of the year stuff and thinking so this season we have been reflecting some on education and many other different topics, but one thing I'm wondering about my earlier comments here just a few minutes ago is you know, as we see students leave after 4 years and we're seeing faculty and staff leave under normal work circumstances, like that happens at workplaces all the time. I've worked in other places in a non-academic environment where your coworkers leave, right? That happens. People get fired, people get hired, people move. It just happens. Mm-hmm. There's something unique about the academic environment and about like a college environment where it feels like more than work.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like it's weird because relationships you build.
There's this sense of development that like that is the job, right? You're developing people for whatever's next. So at least with the relationship with the students, it's like you get 4 years specifically to see them grow. And to help them grow.
And even, you know, even with faculty, I mean, you and I have had great opportunities to be able to do work together. And it's like you're a team. You know, it's got to feel in some ways maybe like what a team feels like after they've been through a few seasons together and they've gone through the grind of like trying to accomplish a goal and then the team gets split up, you know, it's got to feel a bit like that where that, and I guess, you know, when we're talking about like professional sports, it's like, well, yeah, that's the business of it, but it's just weird to think about because I'm wondering like to what extent should education be this way?
Right.
You know, like, to what extent should it be like you have people for 4 years together in a spot, you get to do community together to some extent, you know, and you get people working together and we, you know, think of our jobs as ministry.
Right.
And so to what extent should it be that way to where it's kind of like, all right, see you later, move on. Like, I'm not saying that I have a better idea, but there's something about the system that to me sounds like it's so unfortunate. You don't get to continue on very easily in the students' progress and their journeys that they're on, other than just trying to maintain long distance relationships with wherever they're going next.
I think the other thing that I really don't like about the end of the year is it's like push, 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 right? Yeah. It's the most intense time. And then it's this fragmentation and everybody disappears. Oh, and that's not a scattered. Good ending. Yeah.
No. So, you know, the insight, I don't know what the insight is. The insight is like, I wish there was a better way.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is.
As we get ready for the summer break in the podcast, we wanted to let you know that we'll be posting special features on patreon.com/profsandrooms through the summer. As always, you can also find out more about the podcast at profsandrooms.com. We're joined today by Rachel Pye Jones, who is the author of Pillars, How Muslim Friends Led Me Closer to Jesus. If you didn't get a chance yet, we recommend listening to season 2, episode 18 to hear the first half of our conversation with Rachel.
Yeah, we need to have a bigger, more robust, complicated faith.
I think one of the ways that you explore that in the book is through a reconsidering of prayer and the recognition of kind of this magical thinking that our prayer often, it really, Corduan is a Christian writer on religions who, one of the things he talks about is this decay into magic and ritual. And I think when we actually examine our faith, so much of our practical lived experience of Christianity risks being just magic and ritual. And I think even that, one of the things that you observed is that ritual in and of itself isn't necessarily meaningless. Like you talk about some of the things you appreciated seeing with your Muslim neighbors and friends, where ritual can give space to something. But I think it's interesting how we take something that we'll say, well, it's not a religion, it's a relationship, and blah, 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 you know, kind of like talk it up. But then our lived experience often is just magical thinking. And it sounds like for you, over and over and over again, the magical thinking just, it didn't hold up. And so there's this question of, okay, is there anything at the core? And then it also sounds like, and I think this is maybe one of the most surprising things in your book. It's not surprising in the sense that it's in the subtitle, right? But it's surprising that the answer to that question was largely realized in relationship with your Muslim friends and neighbors. How has that happened? That as kind of this, you know, almost, I don't know, as stuff crumbled in your faith, that things that you found life and answers not in the places that maybe our stories would tell us to expect to look for them.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that first happened is that as my Christian faith bumped up against Islam, some of those things were exposed in ways that surprised me. So for my Djiboutian friends, they're very vocal about how they're, for example, their giving is in order to earn a reward. And so sometimes a beggar would come to our house, and our front door at the time was quite far from the front gate. And so we also have a guard. People have guards. It's another way of employing people in the community. He would come up and say, there's a beggar at the gate. They want food. So I would put together a bag of food, and he would say, okay, you did the food, so you get the good points for giving the food. Give it to me and I will carry it to him. So I will also get the good points and the reward for giving it to him. And so he really vocalized the way that what he was doing was hoping for a reward. And I remember thinking that made me really uncomfortable. I'm not giving to get a reward. And yet I kind of was in some ways. In my mind, I was, you know, I said about, if I'm going to stay here and have this baby, God, you better give me a good, healthy baby. Mm. And so I was kind of making these demands or these wagers. And so that way, the conversations and the dialogue with my local friends exposed some of my own faulty belief systems or ways that I was twisting things around.
Were there things too that you noticed? Because this part about prayer, especially, and about the, or the magic thinking, were there things specifically even that you learned from your Muslim, you know, friends in Djibouti about that, that helped to illuminate some of the ways that you'd approached that?
Yeah. So prayer, you know, like giving, you pray in order to get something and you give in order to get something. And so when I came back, I guess I'll use the giving example again. There's this Islamic Sufi poet scholar from a long time ago, Ghazali, and he talked about how even when we give, we should give knowing that we can never give enough. And so I was thinking I'm giving a lot by, you know, giving the food to the beggar, or sometimes in the market I would give, I was helping some women to start little restaurants and giving more substantially, but it was never enough to hurt for myself, never enough to kind of pinch on me. And it wasn't to get this magical reward from God. It was out of obedience, but I still felt like it was never enough. Mm. And so this quote from this Muslim man just helped me understand that I could yes, give, and I could also feel convicted that it wasn't enough. I could do both at the same time, mm-hmm. and let that conviction inspire me to give more, knowing that no matter how much I gave, it would never be enough. And again, because I'm not the hero. I'm not the one that God needs for these things, but I still need to be obedient in being generous. And then when it comes to prayer, you know, I had tried all these different methods to pray, checklists and index cards and all the acronyms, you know, that we can come up with to help guide our prayers. And it just would, it often felt really stilted. Or, you know, if I'm praying for no rain on my wedding day, which I prayed for, and it rained a little bit on my wedding day, it was beautiful. How do I know what's best anyway? Or, you know, maybe someone else is praying for the exact opposite thing, and sort of that prayer competition of who's God going to listen to. It doesn't make sense when we think about prayer in that kind of magical thinking type of way. And so I started to, you know, just as I was wrestling with my own doubts about what prayer means, and looking at my Somali friends and how they were praying in different ways, more structural, more liturgical kind of ways. What is prayer? And we talk about, like you said, a relationship with God, and prayer is becoming still more for me this ongoing dialogue and experience, more than sitting down and making requests or demands mm-hmm. based on what I think might be best, but an experience of God in the world as I'm out. And I have this idea that comes up in the book from Barbara Brown Taylor of hunting for the divine presence. And I talk about in the book as seeking after these sacred signs of God in the world, already at work, whether it's in nature or in humans, and then in prayer becoming response to that, not just like a frou-frou, not really praying because I'm not, you know, talking about it in some way that makes it meaningless, but an experience in which I respond to what I'm seeing, and then and becomes an exchange that I can carry with me throughout the day, if that makes sense. Mm. And of course, I'm still making requests of God. Of course, I'm mm-hmm. still saying, this is what I think would be best right now. This is how I would like for this to go. But it's less of a demand, and it's with less of a magical thinking perspective behind it. It's more of a, this is what I want. And I understand that it might not be how it comes out, but let's see what happens.
How do you, I mean, your kids are a little bit older than mine now. I have a 4-year-old and a 1-year-old, but how do you teach that to your kids? Like I've wrestled with this now, like being a college professor of New Testament, where all of a sudden I'm having to try to talk to my 4-year-old about things in a way that I can't do with my college students. So like, how do you take that notion of prayer and try to, you know, incorporate that like with kids? You know, did you ever wrestle with that idea of as you're like learning that yourself?
Yeah, definitely. Part of it has been for me just speaking prayers out loud more and more and not even saying, okay, now we're going to pray for this person who's been in a car accident, but just driving by the car accident and saying, oh, Jesus, would you touch that family with your healing power? And just, you know, speaking things out as I go through the day, instead of making it only a set prayer time. Mm-hmm. Yes, those are valuable, especially for kids. You know, I think it is valuable for kids, especially to have a real grounded sense of structure. I think that's what they understand, you know, at their level of brain development, mm-hmm. but over time. And so here we'll be driving along the road and you'll see a group of Muslims who are praying outside. So they're bowing down, and my kids would ask me, what are they doing? One of my daughters asked me actually one time, why are they dancing when they pray? Mm-hmm. And because they wash before they pray, she would say, actually, why do they take a bath and then dance when they pray? And so we talked about how prayer for them is really movement and worship, and how I felt like she saw the celebration and the beauty of that. Mm-hmm. And so I guess what I'm saying is that as we go about our daily lives, what we see, whether it's people actually praying, I mean, that's an easy conversation to make about prayer, but you know, other things through our daily life with our kids, I think we can just bring God into it in some kind of way of naturally just talking about how great this meal is that we just made, and thank God for this delicious meal, and not making it like a whole hands folded, heads bowed prayer time, but just that relationship.
That was a selfish question on my part, just because I'm in the midst of like, you know, like the, you know, you before bedtime prayer time thing. And it keeps in like internally, I'm kind of like, oh, there's something about this that's good, but like just seems to miss the point sometimes too. And so, sorry, I had to ask you that selfish question, because I'm like, I loved what you were saying about prayer and that idea. And then I'm like, man, how do I even try to incorporate that like with my kids? That's, I really appreciate that. That's very helpful.
Good.
I do want to ask maybe more specifically about Islam and your interactions with Islam, because there seems to be so much fear in the American church. I went with a group of students to Indonesia in 2017, and we had the opportunity to participate in a workshop with both Muslim and Christian youth from Indonesia. And it was really rich. And we participated for a few days in observing Ramadan with the people there, and then did some host days with Muslim families. And I remember for one of the young ladies on the trip, she was from an area in Minnesota that has a large Muslim population, but had not, her church community, her school community, other things had not equipped her to know how to interact with and actually, you know, Somali Muslim population. And there's a lot of prejudice. And so we're in Indonesia and she makes her first Muslim friend, right? Like becomes friends with a Muslim for the first time. And in some ways it was beautiful, right? Like to realize, oh, I can be friends with somebody from this faith that's so different from my own. I can be friends with somebody whose experience of the world is so different from my own. And yet there's also this sadness that her first 20 something years, she had not been able to experience that, even though there were, you know, Muslim young women that she had grown up, you know, blocks away from. What do you wish American Christians understood about Islam and about Muslim people?
That is a great question. I wish that they understood how much we share, that Muslims have a real conviction that God is great and that God is worth being worshiped, that prayer is real, that spiritual things are real. I think when I see Christians and Muslims at odds with each other, I just feel so sad, because we have so much in common that we could unite over or share and encourage each other in, and instead we make each other enemies. I think that Muslims and Christians have more in common than Christians and people who don't have faith in many ways, about at least about the most important things to us that are precious to us, about God and faith. And so I wish that Christians could see, you know, a Muslim fasting for 30 days during Ramadan. It is hard. I used to judge that fast because, oh, you eat at night, it's not so hard. Oh my goodness, especially in hot countries or where the sun is actually up for a long time, it's really challenging. And so instead of making things like fasting a competition or again, a threat, I think Christians could see in that a real sincere pursuit of God and a real seeking of holy things that we could partner with in some way and encourage our Muslim friends in their fast and be encouraged by them too. So yeah, I just wish that we could appreciate those things about Islam. And there's things like, I've learned a lot about Hagar from my Muslim friends, and that comes up in the book too, but just, she's important in the Quran and in Islamic practice. And so seeing that, then I thought, oh, I wonder what her story is. I want to know more about it. And so I went back to the Bible and studied more. And so that, you know, we can be actually even scripturally encouraged by our interactions with Muslims, by being turned back to our own faith to explore it deeper.
One of the debates that I'm aware of is this question of whether God can be known as Allah, which is in some ways, I think, a very ethnocentric question, because like, I don't know, in Mali, when I worship with Christians, that is the name for God, right? So it's there is no debate in that. And one of my friends in Mali wrote a chapter of a book called What Shall We Name God? And, you know, but how do you think about that? I think you addressed this in the book, but the question of, you know, is Allah as known in Islam the same as God as known in Christianity, which I think actually oversimplifies the question for both faiths. But
yeah, so like you said, on a linguistic level, for me, that issue is, it was settled 2000 years ago whenever people started speaking Arabic, before even Islam began. I do understand that there's a whole nother level to that question of, in terms of identity and character, are we talking about the same thing? And for me, I listen to a couple of different things. One is to Muslims, who, there are even some Muslims out there who follow Jesus, and they say that their understanding of God is not different. They don't feel like they are worshiping a different God. They're worshiping God through Jesus. Or I think about, we share this Abrahamic tradition of one God, one creator God, who made Adam and Eve in the garden, and all the prophets we have in common. I think we share such a heritage. I don't think we have the same understanding of God. And so when I say God or think of God in my mind, and my Muslim friend thinks of God, I don't think we're thinking of the exact same thing, but neither one of us are thinking of it fully, of God fully in that moment, because we can't comprehend all of who God is anyway. And I don't think that I'm thinking the same thing about God as other Christians are either. I mean, we have basic things like Trinity and different things, but our concepts are different and they're all limited. And so that's how I think about it. Yeah, we don't have the same exact ideas, but that I do think there's one God out there, and all kinds of different names, even, you know, French names and Spanish names and Somali names for God.
And some of the linguistic stuff, it is important, I think, to almost minimize that some, because of how much it's been pushed to the center. Like my students are a little bit shocked sometimes when we talk about what Jesus means in Greek and how it pulls from, you know, the Hebrew name for Joshua. I mean, I think they're a little bit surprised, because it's like they think that the Americanized English version of the name is like what matters the most. And it's like, man, there's just some of the linguistic stuff gets overplayed sometimes. And in that particular article that Stephen was mentioning from your friend, you know, he even brings up just the way that the name for God was adopted, the word God was adopted in the Greek language. And so I think it is good sometimes to minimize some of that linguistic stuff, because it gets pushed to the center of some of these discussions. So I appreciate where you went, though, in terms of talking about our conception of God and some of the ways that those can differ. But yeah, some linguistic stuff I think gets overplayed.
As you think about your relationships with Muslim friends, whether that's in East Africa or during your time in Minneapolis, which was what, like 20 years ago, I guess. But what brings you delight?
So we do go back to Minneapolis every summer for a little bit, like a month or two. And I love spending time with Somalis in Minneapolis. I did before too, but now I know so much more about this part of the world, and I know some language. And so we share these things that they are often very surprised to see that we have in common. So I love the senses of humor and the cross-cultural, even faux pas mistakes that I make with my friends, and they just laugh. They laugh a lot at me. You know, the challenges of cross-cultural life make me more curious and more interested to keep exploring and learning more things. I love asking my friends, one of my favorite questions to ask a Muslim is, what do you love about being a Muslim? And I just watch their eyes light up, because they realize, oh, this is how we're going to talk, you know, with a Christian. We're not going to talk about fighting together or disagreeing. We are probably going to disagree at some point. I'm not afraid of disagreeing either. I can press into that. But just the way that they'll respond to that question, What do you really love about being a Muslim? It's just really a fun conversation. And they'll, you know, often turn it back on me. What do you love about being a Christian? And then I get to share too. And that's just really fun. Even on like a small level, this morning I took a refugee to the COVID testing center to get a test, and everyone's wearing masks, right? So our mouths are covered. You can only see the eyes. And as I'm helping him get registered, I was speaking Somali with him, and the woman registering me, I could just see in her eyes this delight of, what is this foreign woman, blonde curly hair, doing, speaking Somali? And the way it changed the whole dynamic of how we were interacting, you know, that's like a small thing to me now, but it's a steady source of those delights that I really enjoy. Mm-hmm.
It seems like such a different, such an important relational and like conversation to have, instead of approaching things always as like, let's get down to the gist of how we differ on various things. You know, it's like, it's just so much more humanizing on both ends to just be able to share, you know, the pleasures and joys of our experiences and our various, you know, even in just some of our religious experiences, rather than trying to, I feel like sometimes as Christians, people are taught these methods of conversing with people from the religious perspectives that is just very dehumanizing. It's like they can reduce them to a belief or something and then just, you know, center on that for a while and try to convince them otherwise or something. And it just seems so, so different from what you're describing, which is just a much more profound, just like relational experience where you're seeing the value in the other person beyond just a belief or something like that.
What would you say? So we have a class on encountering world religions. And so the focus is really on the encounter rather than like trying to somehow master, you know, trivia about other religions. And I find that students sometimes are unsettled when they begin to discover the humanity of people from other faiths. And when they start to discover that there is beauty present in other faiths. And it's, I think many times what they have assumed up to that point is, well, I have Christianity because Christianity is the only good faith, right? And there's nothing good in any of the others. And so it can be really unsettling for them as they begin to encounter these points of contact, things that we have in common. And then also to discover that sometimes people from other faiths, I mean, I think always people from other faiths are doing some element of life better or more altruistically than we are, right? How would you encourage them or what would you say to them? Because I think there's this temptation to say, oh, see, this is a trick of the enemy, right? To make me lose my faith, you know? And so I don't even want to acknowledge that there would be beauty or goodness over there on the other side.
I definitely thought that. I thought, you know, all other people need to do is hear a little bit about Jesus and about Christianity, even American Christianity. And I had a lot of cultural baggage tied up in that. And then they will love it too, because it's obviously the best, you know, so making it this competitive thing. And I realized right away that Muslims feel really served by Islam. They have meaningful community and holidays that they love and traditions that they do year after year because it means something and it's valuable to them. So that definitely was shaking for me. I remember walking through that a lot. And I think what it comes back down to for me is just to, again, encourage students. What I needed to be encouraged in was that, yeah, I do find this really beautiful and really compelling, Christianity. I am very content and happy and satisfied in Jesus because it's not relying on me. Jesus is holding on to me. I'm not the one holding on to him. I'm in that too, but I'm not relying on myself to keep me in faith. I'm relying on the faithfulness of Jesus to keep me in faith. And so, and he's never going to be faithless toward me. And so I can rest in that and then be willing to see what someone else can find valuable or good about their faith. And I, even at some point, we can talk about that together, about why I love Jesus and why I'm not becoming a Muslim. I've had friends ask me, you know, do you want to become a Muslim? And why not? And so we'll talk about it. And I think that's okay too, just to be really honest. Like, I'm so happy loving Jesus and I'm going to stay right here, but I'm willing to talk to you about where you're coming from. And again, it comes back to not feeling threatened by our differences or even by some of our similarities, but to be able to grow together.
That's rich. Yeah, I think the threat of similarity is maybe one of those unexpected threats. But yeah,
that jarred me when I was talking with after I graduated from college. I met some Mormon missionaries who were living in an apartment complex I lived in, and you know, I was always taught just kind of surface level things about Mormonism. And when I realized like how seriously they took their faith, how genuinely good human beings they were, how they were practicing their faith more rigorously than I was, that really jarred me quite a bit. And then it was interesting because what I began to realize though is that, you know, I got asked kind of similar questions from them about, well, why don't you become a Mormon? And it was interesting because I, you know, kind of explained to them some of those things. But then I realized very quickly that we had actually had kind of very similar perspectives, which was once they realized I wasn't going to become a Mormon, they kind of just cut off, severed ties with me. And, and which is very much so how my background or my tradition and Christianity also would have done it for them, you know. So this isn't an indictment on them, but so I don't know. I found it to be a jarring experience on the one hand of the seeing the similarities and then of going, oh, wait, actually, there's also similarities of the way we would just cut off conversation with each other when it's like, oh, you're not going to convert. All right. Mm-hmm. What point is there in being friends then? Which it doesn't sound like your Muslim friends felt that way when you tell them why you aren't, you know, maybe going to convert to Islam.
No. And, you know, I think there can be a real fear that will lean into universalism or some kind of wishy-washy faith if we start talking about things we have in common or not being threatened by these other religions, whether it's Mormonism, these things. And I think what I would also want to encourage students is this is not wishy-washy universalism. This is deep conviction and confidence in my faith, and that making me comfortable with you not having to agree with me. Mm-hmm. I don't need someone else to agree with me to validate or verify my own faith. Mm-hmm. And I also don't need to dumb it down. And I hope that they're not dumbing it down either. Mm-hmm. And, you know, most of the time they're not. My Muslim friends are also standing in their conviction, and I don't want them to water it down for my sake. And so, you know, if we can come at each other with a lot of respect that way instead. And yeah, I'm really thankful that they have not cut me off in that same way that I was kind of encouraged to do as a Christian, or that Mormons were too for you.
Yeah.
I think that so much of the conversation has come back to this theme that you mentioned early, which is this idea of being centered instead of being central. Mm-hmm. And I really like that way of thinking about it, that if I'm centered in Christ, if I'm centered in truth, then I don't have to be at the center of feeling okay about, you know, this interaction, or I don't know. Yeah. I just think that gives so much space. Yeah. And that sense of generosity in relationship that you mentioned, but also that you demonstrate. What brings you hope?
A couple of things. One, I feel so glad that I can see the global Christian body in a unique way from Djibouti. So like I mentioned earlier, with our church, we have such diversity of where people are coming from, ethnic diversity, economic diversity, Christian tradition, you know, all these things. And it's a beautiful thing. I think that the American church would be really encouraged if she could look at the global body that she's a part of, instead of only at the American church right now, which is pretty broken and struggling in some significant ways, not necessarily struggling, but wrestling with big things. Mm-hmm. And if we could look at the global body that we are part of, I think we would be very encouraged as a Christian community. And so I love that. I have kind of a front row seat in some ways to that, more than I would if I was in Minnesota. I read somewhere that the average Christian today is actually a Nigerian woman. Mm-hmm. And so if we think about what Christianity looks like, it looks like a Nigerian woman in Nigeria. Yeah. And another thing that gives me hope is, back to the book, the foreword is written by a Somali Muslim American man named Abdi Noor Iftin. And for me, when he agreed to write that foreword, and then when I read it and I look at the cover of the book, which has my name, talks about Jesus, it has his name right on it. And I feel like this is a tangible example of what I'm trying to do in the world, of how I try to live, what I want the book to do, how I want people to respond to it, in terms of we can come together and we don't have to agree, but we can, Muslim, Christian, we can make something beautiful and good together. And so that gives me a lot of hope that we don't have to settle into this language of being enemies or fear, but that we can partner and talk.
One of the other names on your book on the back is Eboo Patel. And I remember hearing him talk about this idea that So with his work with the Interfaith Youth Corps in Chicago, talking about the idea that people from different faiths can come together and work on things that we have in common. And I remember him saying, he was like, you know, I don't even mind if you try to convert me, because I understand that that's an expression of love, or it can be, right? I don't think it always is, but let's not make that the only thing that we talk about. And I just remember being really struck by that. Yeah. So I think the book, yeah, occupies this really needed space. Yeah. So I have hope, I think, in part because I see that in the midst of, yeah, the brokenness, the wrestling, the pain in the American church today. And I think especially in the, there's a real question, particularly for white American expressions of Christianity, of saying, what are we even about actually? And I think I'm encouraged when I see God moving in ways like through this book that creates another space, that creates a way to say, well, you know, let's step over here to the side and think about this differently. And I think, yeah, the idea that God is not leaving his people without witnesses to who he would have us be in the world. So I'm encouraged by that.
What would you call Jesus followers to you today?
So I think of Pillars, the book, and the way that I try to live as a kind of holy welcome. And so I would encourage followers of Jesus today to think about ways that they can offer a holy welcome to other people and receive a holy welcome from other people. So, for example, I was at a peace building interfaith gathering in Minneapolis several years ago, and a Somali woman sat down next to me, and she heard I lived in Djibouti. And she said, oh, my nephew lives in Djibouti. He just moved there. He doesn't speak French. So the teacher put him next to a little girl who spoke English and French to translate for him. And I said, oh, is your nephew's name Najib? And she says, oh, yeah. And I said, he's sitting right next to my daughter.
No way. And,
small world.
No
right?
way.
And so we were laughing about this. And then the call to prayer goes off. And she grabs my hand and she says, come pray with me. And before I could say anything, like, is this okay with your community? What are people going to think if a Christian goes to pray with a Muslim? And she says, look, I know you're not a Muslim. I know you're not becoming a Muslim, but you fear God, right? Let's go pray together. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, like, this feels like a holy welcome. She's welcoming me into her sacred space. She knows that I'm not converting, but we can meet God together in some way there. And so I think that's what I would encourage followers of Jesus today to consider, how can you invite someone into your sacred space? How can you offer somebody a holy welcome? And then if somebody is offering you that same thing into their sacred space, go there with them and see what you can experience about God together.
That's great. That's the kind of approach you're talking about too. I think that is just, it's so enriching compared to the stuff that I was taught when I was here as a student, on the way that we even just think about, you know, interreligious friendships and things like that. It's just, I really appreciate everything you're saying here.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode. Please comment, like, and share. Our theme music is by Josiah Enns. Reed Peters is a recognized patron of the show. We hope you can join us for coffee again next time.